Welcome to the Natural Selection Presents Shells. Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of the Natural Selection Presents. We're back this week to talk all about shells. But first, we were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, we have Nick.
Hello.
We have Naomi.
Hi.
And I am Other Nick. Hello. Naomi, do you want to tell the listeners who we are?
Yeah, so we are the Natural Selection. We're a group of taxonomists, and we want to bring our passion for nature into the wild. Each session, we meet up and we talk about the natural world. In the first part, we discuss nature news, some interesting research that we find from the last couple of weeks. In the second section, we discuss a different theme, and we talk about how plants and animals relate to that theme. This week's theme is shells.
Beautiful. Thank you, Naomi. So how have your guys' weeks been? Have you had any interesting nature interactions?
Yes, I saw some coots with their babies as I was walking to work one morning. It was very cute.
Cute.
Yes, it was very cute. Yeah, and I've figured out which one's which now, you know, maybe. An Eurasian coot, two of them, and their, I think there was four babies. But it was funny because a couple of days before I saw the coot sitting on the nest. So they must have just hatched quite recently.
Well, don't keep the knowledge from us, Naomi. What's the difference?
So the coot is the one with the white beak, and the hen or moorhen or water hen is the reddish beaked one.
Yeah, I must say I did know the difference between a hen and a coot.
I was just out on my balcony before we filmed this and was looking down at the street below, and I saw some birds flying underneath me. And I know that's not like a really dramatic nature interaction, but I can't remember the last time that I've seen birds flying from directly above. It's a pretty cool perspective.
I saw two pigeons have a fight.
Great.
Yeah, it was quite dramatic. It was there's been some beautiful evenings this week. Just to make Naomi jealous, I was also out on my balcony. Opposite my balcony is a tree, as there sometimes is. And it was a beautiful, calm sort of spring evening with a bright moon and a clear sky. And then all of a sudden, out of the darkness, these two pigeons just started getting argy-bargy and flew up and down the street. And one would follow the other one and basically force it off its perch. It would find a new one and the pigeon would follow it again and force it off its perch. I watched them for quite a long time.
I've seen that before with pigeons, and it's really weird. I don't, like, it just seems like one's just being a jerk for no reason. Like, the other one keeps leaving, and it's like, no, go away.
Yeah. Get further. He's trying to de-escalate the situation, and the other one's not having any of it.
Yeah.
Nasty.
Yeah. Well, I suppose we should get on with the news. And I think this week, Naomi, you wanted to start us on the other side of the world.
Actually, very fitting for last week's theme. So I wanted to talk about a piece of work that was published in Current Biology, and it was produced by researchers from the University of New South Wales, looking at marsupials in Australia. So what they are doing is they're looking at conservation strategies to save the bridled nail-tail wallaby. And what they did is they were using a strategy called head starting, and this has been successfully used in other groups. And the idea behind head starting is that they protect the species from predators at a certain stage. So say, for example, in turtles, that's a strategy that's often used where they'll protect the baby turtles on the beach as they make their way into the water from predators that will get them. And the idea behind it is that once they get to an adult size or to a slightly different area, they'll improve their chances of survival. So for the wallabies, they were finding that in 2015 in central Queensland, there was about 16 of these left. And so what they were doing is in this nature refuge in Avocet in central Queensland, they were fencing off the wallabies from because they were being killed by feral cats before they could reach adulthood. When you look at the number of adults, the survival rate goes up to about 80% when they reach a certain size. Of the 56 bridled nail-tail wallabies that they raised in these Head Start enclosures, about 89% of them survived to be large enough to get let back into the wild. And this is kind of an interesting strategy because, one, it's relatively cost effective. So say compared to a full nature reserve where they completely eliminate all of the feral cats as predators. And the other benefit that this has is that it doesn't necessarily get rid of their natural predator response because they're still exposed to their actual natural predators, which would be eagles and snakes. So they wouldn't become kind of naive because that could be a fear that could happen say if they've been exposed to no predators for maybe 2 or 3 years, it could easily happen that they would get quite bold. But then once they come in contact with their natural predators, that could be quite detrimental to them, because when they're in this area, they will get a benefit because they'll get more food if they're being bold. But if they have natural predators, this may not be the case. But now there's about to be 500 animals that are living in the wild, and there's more than 2,000 in captivity. So this is an interesting strategy. It hasn't ever been done before for mammals. Like I said, it's something that's been used in other species, so say reptiles like turtles or birds. But this is something maybe that they could use for other mammal species that may help, kind of as a strategy until they're able to get rid of the not native feral cats. This may be something that can kind of help keep their population stable.
Good luck to those little pouchy guys.
Yeah, less than a week after the marsupial episode, Nick has referred to them as little pouchy guys.
That's literally what marsupial means. We went over this.
I find the idea quite... There's quite a horrific element and a humorous element of trying to instill the fear of eagles into naive wallabies. That seems like a weird job for what is probably a PhD student.
Yeah, or an unpaid master's.
Yeah. So my news is related to conservation as well. It's related to wolves. You've probably seen recently there's a spate of papers relating to how in reintroducing predators has a positive impact on environments, or even the people who live near those environments. This is a political issue, especially in the United States, where the popular consensus is against reintroducing predators for fears of safety or perhaps livestock concerns or having a negative effect on the local economy and things like that. Now, what's interesting is this paper focused on the economic impact of reintroducing predators, and they actually found that it could be positive for the local economy. So what they were looking at is that wolves make roads safer. A big problem in rural communities in the United States is vehicle collisions with deer. Obviously, deer can be quite large. This can even be deadly, but at the very least, it will very much ruin your car. And what they found is when looking in Wisconsin after the reintroduction of wolves, wolf entry reduced deer vehicle collisions by 24%. And this is an economic benefit that is 63 times greater than the cost of verified wolf predation on livestock. So this is a study in PNAS, and they found that most of the reduction is actually due to a behavioral response of the deer rather than the actual predation itself. So it's more the fear of the wolves in the area than it is that the wolves are killing enough deer that there's less collisions. And they found because of this, a lot of the argument is, well, human hunters could replace that, sort of people with rifles shooting the weak of the herd will also have this similar effect. But because it's actually the fear and behavior that's affecting this, it appears it's actually better than human deer hunters. So we're not an adequate replacement for wolves in the environment, even when we're trying to actively be that. So yeah, it's a good economic argument for reintroducing wolves into their natural habitat.
That's really fascinating. I wonder, though, if it will be enough that it will take away kind of some of the stigma of, because even though you're saying it does actually outweigh the cost of them predating on livestock. I wonder, though, if it's still that kind of pushback from people, because I mean, I guess it's something we talked about before, but like wolves are kind of cast as the villain, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, I was looking at predators, but Nick, you found something on herbivores.
I did. Surprise. I mean, they're my my lieblings tier, as they say here in Germany, the large herbivores. So this is a study on large herbivores in their ecological contexts, published last week in Current Biology by a team of researchers based in the US, the UK, and Kenya. They were looking at the relationships between large herbivores, plants, and pollinators in the savanna in central Kenya. And they're interested in finding out how the relationships between plants and pollinators would change with the presence or absence of these large herbivores. So basically, what effect these herbivores have on the relationship between plants and pollinators. And the idea was they were sort of trying to decide between, because sometimes the herbivores can like grays the sort of primary dominant species that then allows smaller, like many more diverse smaller species to appear. But at other times, they can sort of reduce the growth of plant diversity. And it sort of depends on the in different ecosystems, the load of herbivores in the environment, which changes during the rainy and the dry season. So they did this during both the rainy and the dry season. And they figured out basically that across a huge range of herbivores, from the smallest antelopes to the largest elephants, at all times of year, they limited the presence of large herbivores, limited the resources available to pollinators by either reducing the abundance of flowers or the diversity of flowers that were in the ecosystem. So they would chew basically the buds off the plants. So that meant that fewer pollinators visited and there was a lower diversity of pollinators in the ecosystem in general when there were large herbivores present. When there weren't large herbivores, so they had some areas of the, I think it was a wildlife reserve that they were looking at, that were fenced off from large herbivores, there were more flowers and more types of flowers. Pollinators became more diverse, and then the size of these plant pollinator networks increased, and the interactions between them increased as well. So more pollinators were going to more different types of plants, and different types of pollinators were pollinating the same flowers. So like the network became more complex between the plants and the pollinators. And there are sort of these overlaps of function in the pollinator web. And they also found that this reduced the vulnerability of certain pollinators to local extinction or to like being able to stick around, basically. So I don't know. Interesting. We don't like to imagine a natural ecosystem without these large herbivores. It's sort of what a lot of conservation science, I think, is trying to do is like maintain the presence of large herbivores. But it's also interesting to think that, you know, if in places where they aren't present, a lot of different types of diversity, plant and insect diversity increases. So that's interesting too.
Cool, that's great. I mean, it's kind of nice that we both had news on why predators and herbivores are both good.
And bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but it's always good to get both sides.
Yeah. Brilliant. That does bring us to the end of the news. Please join us after this short break, where we'll be back to talk about our theme this week, which is shells. Welcome back, listeners. So we are back to talk about shells. Something we can all imagine. We can probably all think of an animal with a shell. But I thought I'd start us off on animals without a shell, which may seem like an odd place to start. But the reason I wanted to start here is because they used to have a shell and lost it. And this is the cephalopods. This includes the octopuses, the squids, the cuttlefish, and of course the nautiluses. Nautili? Nautili sounds wrong. Now, they are mollusks, and if you think of mollusks, you tend to think of things like snails, bivalves, things that are pretty shelly. They're quite shelly. And cephalopods started off with shells. In fact, the very first one was a very early Cambrian. So there was a study that actually put them, they originally thought would to be quite early in the Cambrian, but yeah, there's a study that put them right towards the beginning of it. It's a really exciting time in the development of life, and cephalopods were there at the beginning. And they're basically used to shuffle along the seafloor of relatively shallow seas, I understand. And they had a shell on the top. Now, there is theories that, yeah, basically the development of the shell appeared not long after the evolution of predators, which, yeah, when you think about it, makes sense. So it's most likely that this early cephalopod was trying to avoid being eaten by having a hard shell on its back to protect its mantle or soft bits. Now, what made this special is it did something amazing. Now, this cephalopod used to segment its shell into different sections. So it wasn't just one big container. There was different areas within this container and that they could, yeah, do different things in each section. And what they had is an amazing organ called the siphuncle. And what this did, it was really novel. So what they could do is this actually basically was an organ that ran through all the different sections of their shell, going up vertically through it. And what they could do is they could pump very salty fluid through this siphuncle. And it meant all of the fluid in their shell surrounding it, by osmosis, because it was less salty, would be drawn into their siphuncle and but would be replaced with gas. And this, replacing this fluid which was contained in their shell with gas, made their shell buoyant. And they would float up from the sea surface. And this meant that the cephalopods could start to explore, yeah, the verticality of the sea rather than just shuffling about on the sea floor. this shell became really, really important, not just for maneuvering, but for protection, because it was around this time that jawed fish evolved. And if you might know about jawed fish, is they live in the similar area of the sea and they like to bite. So all of a sudden, their shells became really, really important. And it became sort of an arms race between cephalopods and jawed fish, where the jawed fish are trying to bite through their shells and the cephalopods are building stronger and stronger ones. And there's evidence on this when they look at ammonite fossils. So they often look at, as they evolved through time, their shells became more complex. They assume this was to relate to strength. But in fact, looking at the studies, it may also be related to buoyancy as well. So yeah, even as they evolved, these two things became, yeah, were linked intrinsically with their shell. It was related to buoyancy and strength. Now, one thing it meant that it couldn't do was essentially go quite deep. There was a group of cephalopods which evolved to have their sort of shell inside their mantle. And they would use this as a buoyancy aid inside their mantle. But this buoyancy aid couldn't go very, very deep at all, because essentially the crushing weight would crush it and it'd become useless. So to go deep, they had to completely lose this buoyancy method, which is something that octopuses and squids did. Now, the shells which originally protected the ammonites would be their downfall. When there was the big extinction at the end of the dinosaur age, at the end of the Cretaceous period, there was a huge change in pH levels in the sea, which would affect the amount of carbon in the sea as well. And this meant that young ammonites, which used their shells entirely for buoyancy, were unable to produce calcium carbonate in the seas due to the pH levels. Yeah, they died out. Well, all of the cephalopods, which had sought refuge in the deeper sea and found their own niche, suddenly found that there was these huge niches out in the open ocean, which are open again. And they went back up and filled all of the niches left by the now extinct ammonites. So that is how we ended up with a group of mollusks without shells. Now, there is one exception. There's a few species of nautilus, which are actually descended from those very, very early shelled cephalopods. So they did still survive. And the reason they think they survived this extinction was basically they have a really slow lifestyle and they just chilled through it. So they weren't too frantic and they just were slow and steady and outlived the extinction. So yeah, nice. So there is one left if you want to see a shelled cephalopod.
Nice. Those are the really beautiful ones, right? The ones that have the sort of like mottled, like sepia and cream colored shells. The Natural History Museums. Cool. Those are so beautiful.
Now, Nick, I think you were also attracted to mollusks, weren't you?
I was. I wanted to talk today a bit about snails, shells, spirals, and some scaffolding solutions for shells. No, beyond the alliteration, Nick, I'm glad that you talked so much about the shell was a key innovation, I think, in at least in the mollusk and cephalopod group that sort of expanded the world of the animals that you're talking about. But similarly, the shell can do lots of things, and I want to talk today about snails. And so I started by doing a little bit of research on snails, and I started off with reading a sentence that said, marine snails have a larval stage, but land snails don't. And it's such a simple sentence, but it's like spun me off onto like a wormhole of research to try to figure out why that is. And then it was like a Socratic seminar in paper. It was like question after question after question coming at me. I was like, but why? But why? But why? So I'll lead you, I think, on a clear path to a cool solution or a cool answer to this. A little bit of background first. Many marine gastropods have a little tiny unshelled larval stage called a veliger, whereas land snails have direct development. Land snails emerge directly from the egg, looking morphologically like adults with a tiny shell. Super cute. So I think there's a pretty clear reason for that. There's a lot of environmental and ecological differences between living in the sea and living on land. And one of the most important is that you don't get a chance to sort of get swept around and moved around as larva to find a new place. You're really where your egg comes out, there you are. And you have to deal with the predators and the food resources and the sort of hostile environmental conditions that hit you right when you get out of the egg from one shell to another. So what are the differences, was my next question, between living on land and living in the sea for a snail? And the main ones that come to mind, I don't know if you guys want to jump in at any point, you're like, I know one. The differences between living on land and in the sea for snails. Any thoughts?
Wetness.
Bingo. No, you're right, Nick. It's exactly right. The danger of desiccation, of drying out, is a huge problem for land snails. And actually, marine snails took a long time to move onto land. It wasn't like they were always in and out. They had to adapt to that dryness. So desiccation, dryness. Any others?
Saltiness?
saltiness, or yeah, the sort of environmental conditions and resources. They had to maintain moisture and the proper balance and pH of their bodies. And one way of doing that is when things get tough, hiding in the shell. And one of the things that I didn't think about is moving around. I mean, it's obvious when you think about it for a second, but the shell weighs a lot to a little snail, and moving in the water, it doesn't weigh as much. And when you're on land, you have to carry the whole thing around. So the weight of the shell and moving that around is a big thing that they have to sort of build into their body plans. And then that got me thinking about, okay, wait, how exactly does the snail shell function in a structural way? And I did a little research into this and was seeing, okay, actually, the snail shell isn't just a little house it carries on its back. It does provide protection, and it is a little home that the snail can retreat into, but it's also a place that the muscles attach to, and it's the thing that the muscles can move and push against. And it's actually even more amazing that slugs can exist without a shell, because the shell provides like a scaffold for them to do anything. The snails can move around a lot easier with a shell. And then I started thinking, well, how do other animals solve the problems of scaffolding? So I'll go through some of the major phyla, the body plans, because it's like an ever outward spiral of body mechanics. Anyway, so I got sort of swept away by this. But worms are like, no way, not for me, no scaffolding, just pure muscle. They just are going to lift all day, just worms. Vertebrates, we know, we figured out, how did we do it? We put our scaffolding inside. So we have an internal skeleton, and we can attach our muscles to it and move around, but it doesn't provide protection from things like the sun or drying out. It provides protection from falling into a pile of goo. Arthropods, I think, come the closest to what I finally got to here, which is that they have an external shell like snails that protects them from predators, from drying out, from solar radiation, and it gives their muscles something to pull and push against. But it's segmented, and every time they want to get a little bit bigger, they have to shed it. They have to molt and make a whole new shell, which is pretty cost intensive. With snails, I figured out a pretty cool way of going about this by making a spiral shell. They've got the solution to this external protection and the internal scaffolding, and anytime they want to get a little bit bigger, they just add on to the outside of the spiral, and they can just get bigger that way indefinitely. I mean, a snail obviously isn't going to grow to the size of a house, but it's a cool way of sort of solving that resource problem that arthropods solve by molting, but in doing it a different way, by having this sort of sequential growth at the edge of the growth plate. I hope that answers some of those questions that came up, and I hope more that it brings up more questions.
I like that it's still called scaffolding when they're building a house.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's the technical biological term, but sounds right.
That's really cool. I like that.
I like snails now. I didn't know much about them before.
I do know that, yeah, you sort of mentioned, yeah, the difference in environment of like wetness and saline and heat and dryness and things. I do know that one of the hardest environments to sort of establish yourself in is the tidal area, because you spend half the day in the baking sun and half the day in saline water. And yes, snails are often quite good at that.
Cool guys. Yeah. Little creatures.
But there's another animal which sort of spends its time sometimes on a beach, but mainly in the ocean. And I think, yeah, Naomi, you wanted to talk about them.
I wanted to talk about the group called Testudinae. So that is turtles. It also includes tortoises, terrapins, and their extinct relatives. So interestingly enough, some people refer to them as Chelonae, which I think is what, so they use that to talk to about the order, but just when they're talking about the living turtles, tortoises, and terrapins. So for the rest of this, I'm going to use the word turtle to talk about this whole group, because actually kind of the difference between turtles and tortoises is kind of more of a language thing than a taxonomy thing for this instance. And depending on where you are, some places just refer to the whole group as a turtle or a tortoise, depending. So just for ease, I'll use turtle to kind of talk about the whole group. So in particular, I wanted to talk about the turtle shell, as our episode theme is shell. It's a pretty distinctive characteristic of turtles. And it's really cool, actually, how they make their shell. So there's a couple of different technical words which I'll try and use, but hopefully it won't be too confusing. The shell is primarily made of bone, and it's made of two parts. So the carapace, which is the bit at the back, and that's maybe got 50 or 60 bones, and this covers the back of the animal. And then the plastron, which is maybe 7 or 11 bones, and that covers the belly. So they are connected by extensions of the plastron, so they kind of go up at the side. And then the carapace is fused with the vertebrae and the ribs, which is really cool because if you think about it, the turtle is kind of inside out because its ribs are over its legs. I know, yeah.
I really don't like that thought.
Yeah, I know. I was one of the things I was reading phrased it like that. I was like, yeah, kind of makes sense because its ribs are outside of outside of its legs and stuff. But yeah, so they've got some cool adaptations there. And then on the outer surface of that, the shell is covered in epidermal scales, which are called scutes. And these are made of keratin. So keratin is the same substance that makes up human hair and fingernails. And a turtle has typically about 38 scutes on their carapace and about 16 on the plastron, which is the belly. So 54 in total. And I think they also have names depending on their location, so it gets kind of complicated in terms of terminology. As far as I could tell when I was looking it up, the leatherback was one that it doesn't have scutes. It has kind of a leathery covering instead of this keratin. I was trying to see if there was other turtles that have this. I think there are a couple of other softshell turtles, but I couldn't find specific groups. Brief kind of aside I'd like to talk about in turtles and turtle anatomy, which hopefully will help me in my next section about turtles. I doubled down this week and I went all turtles. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the skulls of turtles. Kind of as an overview in an amniote skulls, there are fenestral openings, which are openings behind the eye sockets. They're kind of holes in the skull. And depending on how many of those the skull has, they can be classified into different groups. And what's interesting about the turtle is that they don't have any openings. And so this would technically classify them as an anapsid skull. But if you decide that they're an anapsid skull, it means that they're not related to things that people think they're related to. So it would make them further away from things like reptiles, living lizards that they think they are related to. So it's an interesting idea when they're looking at the early evolution of turtles and kind of whether they actually had these openings and they lost them or whether they never had them at all. So this is something I'll bring up again in a little while.
I'm still a little bit trying to wrap my head around the ribs are outside the legs. Don't like that.
No, I'm not about that either.
But it's pretty cool to see the inside of a turtle carapace, to see the ribs fused into the top part of the shell. Looks pretty awesome.
Totally unrelated to what you're talking about, but did you see Ecuador has announced they discovered a giant tortoise on a Galapagos island that they thought was extinct for 100 years? Cool, that's amazing. Yeah, I look forward to learning more about how it evolved. Now, Nick, you're a mammal guy, and while you probably really like turtles, I imagine that you were drawn to the mammal that's probably most like a turtle.
Nick, you're always spot on in these transitions. I had to bring a mammal in, and I thought I could do, you know, an armadillo, but why stop there? Go big or go home. So I looked at the group of armadillos, the Cingulata cingulates, I think, in English, but I don't know. I looked at the cingulates, three families of mammals in the Xenarthra group, which are known mostly from South America, that have external bony carapaces, like tortoises and turtles. But this group, the only living family of this group are the armadillos. But it's much more diverse than I realized. There are two other groups, and both those other two groups went extinct in recent times, in the late Pleistocene, especially and most sort of dramatically, the glyptodonts. So I'd heard of them before, and I've seen little bits of their fossil carapaces, but to see one in person would have been really astounding, I think. These were a family of the armadillo-like ancestors that lived in South America, and they grew up to 2 tons with a 400 kilogram or 888 pound armor shell. The thing that distinguished them from the rest of this group is that their carapace has fused into one single unit. Unlike most armadillos and other mammals that have different types of shells and carapaces today, that they're often overlapping or in segments. But this group has completely fused it. So it's like a little box or like a tank, even I think more than a tortoise, in that the top and bottom are fused together. But I'm not sure about turtles and tortoises. Naomi will have to knock me on that one if I got that wrong. But they are approximately 8 feet or 2.5 meters long, and they're covered from head to toe in this bony armor. Their head also has this special bony plate armor. And in most of them, particularly the one genus that made its way up to North America, they have a tapered tail. But in one genus that was found in South America, their tail expands at the end into a mace-like club, complete with spikes on the ends. So some researchers were looking at how they might have used this club, and whether or not it was just sort of like for display, or if it was used for some sort of defense. And it seems that it could have been used for defense or in mating battles. And they calculated that the power of a blow from the mace would have been enough to smash another Glyptodon's shell. If you've ever seen one of these shells, take a look online, because both the shell and the skeleton of these creatures make them look like cartoon characters. They're pretty crazy. But the idea of an 8-foot-long, 2-ton, basically giant tank walking around in South American jungles is a pretty cool one. And something I would have, it's, if I could pick one animal from the past that I would love to see in real life, it'd be a Glyptodon. Oh, they probably, based on their teeth, they weren't violent, though. They were eating soft vegetation by the riverbank. They were a really slow, sort of gentle creature.
I like that as a sentence. But based on their teeth, they probably weren't violent.
It's true. It's true. They really weren't. They were gentle giants, and they likely went extinct at the end of the Pleistocene due to constriction of their environment, like a warm, damp riverbank that they needed, and the climate got drier and cooler. So,
do you know why armadillos are called armadillos, Nick?
I don't.
How's your Spanish?
Well, not good enough to know what armadillo means.
It means little armored one.
No, I didn't know that. Cingulate, which is the name of the group, comes from Latin for belt, or having a girdle, something wrapped around it. Like, all of them have a little carapace wrapped around their body. Like a little armor belt.
Oh, like Batman.
Exactly, yeah.
Awesome. So it's my turn now. And when I thought shells, I went pretty route one. I thought, what has a shell? An egg. When do we think of eggs? I think the instinct for humans is we think of bird eggs. Birds didn't invent eggs. They merely continued a trend which was started by what they evolved from, or maybe are, depending on who you ask, reptiles. So reptiles were the first to sort of have these hard-shelled eggs as we'd recognize them. You do get eggs, obviously, everything that reproduces sexually produces an egg of sorts, like even we do. But yeah, this sort of hard external egg that you would recognize started with the reptiles. When you guys think of the shape of an egg, you tend to think of that sort of, it's not fully symmetrical, it's not like a circle. It's not like a sphere, it's sort of that elongated shape. And we did talk about this once. Do you guys remember why it has that shape?
Yeah, totally. It's for aerodynamic streamlining.
Yeah. So basically, birds have to fly, so they're trying to be as aerodynamic as possible. This is less of an issue for reptiles, because they very rarely fly through the air, depending if scientists are discovering what happens when you fire a lizard out of a cannon.
No, that was tardigrades.
Oh, tardigrades, sorry. I thought it was two Ataras. Yeah, so birds have this rather strange shape. Originally, do you know what the original proposal was of why they had this shape?
Was it that they got squashed coming out?
No. So this was, I love this as a bit of logic, and it does make sense. It's because reptiles lay their eggs on the floor, it's not such an issue. But birds, which lay their eggs up high, see if they want to stop their eggs rolling out of a nest, they wouldn't want spherical eggs. So they originally proposed that the reason they were like this is so they wouldn't sort of roll off the nest off a cliff or something and break. But no, it's actually very much linked to wing shape. So it is to do with streamlining. But yeah, so the reptiles, they don't have this problem, so they can lay these sort of circular eggs. So that's the first major difference, is the sort of shape. Now, the other one, when you often see things like crocodiles laying eggs, they'll often you'll see that the shells are quite soft. The sort of eggs, as we're very familiar with when we're cooking or baking, are quite hard shells. I mean, they're not the strongest, but they are hard. Whereas, yeah, reptile ones can be quite soft. Do you know why this might be?
This is probably not the answer you're going for, but it sounds like one has more calcium carbonate in it than the other.
Do you know, I imagine you're right. I mean, that is a why. But why would they bother putting more calcium carbonate in than otherwise? And they think there are a few reasons. It's hard to be definitive because we can't ask them. And they're not very chatty. But there's a few main theories which on why reptile eggs can be softer. So the first one is that this means they can actually be laid at an earlier stage because soft eggs can continue to expand outside of the body, whereas hard eggs are set in that shape. So if a reptile wants to lay an egg or an earlier stage of development, the egg can still expand and get bigger, whereas a hard egg can't. So it's sort of locked into that developmental stage. With a soft egg, there's a bit more flexibility and it can lay it when it's smaller and probably is more beneficial to the parents. The second one is when you associate what birds do with their eggs, you sort of imagine them incubating them, sitting on them, keeping them warm. This is actually very, very rare for reptiles. They tend not to incubate their eggs at all. So they don't need to be very strong because there's not a giant thing sitting on them. Whereas, yeah, birds that have to sit on their babies, it pays to make them a bit stronger. The last one, and to me seems like the most convincing, is related to water transfer. And there's a reason it seems convincing to me and to other scientists, obviously, and to real scientists, obviously, is there's exceptions which seem to match. So birds can lay their eggs in drier environments than reptiles. And this is because they lay hard eggs, which means that water can't really get in and can't really get out. Now, you think in a dry environment, and this might be a problem if water can't get in. But the reason is how the energy is broken down by the developing embryo. So the fatty yolk in birds is broken down and water is produced as a byproduct, which means there's more essentially water contained within the egg that's accessible by the developing embryo than in reptile eggs. Our reptile eggs primarily use protein as a source of energy and do not produce as much metabolic water, which means that they have to get water from outside of the shell, which means that it has to be permeable and is not hard. And this is probably really, really the crucial point, because some turtles which have hard eggs, they are laying their eggs in marine environments or sort of places where there might be salt water, and they actually do want to limit the amount of water that can get into their egg, because otherwise it would burst the egg. So it could be related to water transfer. A little insight there into the difference between the shells of bird eggs and reptile eggs, in case you were wondering.
I was wondering, but I then was when you started talking about it, and now I'm not, so thank you. I love the don't squash your babies theory.
Well, it makes sense, I suppose.
Yeah.
And that brings us on nicely to Naomi, because I mentioned there that turtles sometimes lay hard eggs, and you wanted to talk about another hard part of turtles.
Yes. So I wanted to talk about, as I kind of alluded to in my last part, I wanted to talk about turtle shells and then how they evolve. So there's a little bit of controversy about some of the specimens of fossils that I'm going to talk about and kind of whether they actually are turtles or not, but I'll walk you guys through it. And also, as I kind of alluded to in the earlier part as well, it kind of, the placement of turtles is kind of still a little bit up in the air as well. So kind of some of these fossils maybe shed light on it as well. One of the first fossils that kind of has been found that I wanted to talk about is called Uinotosaurus, and it is a extinct genus of reptile, and some people say that it may be closely related to turtles, but they're not 100% sure. It's kind of a little bit up in the air because I think maybe it's something that just did something similar to turtles and it's kind of outside of the turtle group. What's cool about this fossil is basically that it has wide and flat ribs that kind of form broad plates, and it's kind of considered maybe a bit of a missing link in the idea that it might be a primitive turtle. So the vertebrate are nearly identical to those of turtles, and what's cool about this is that it sort of helped. There was a debate about whether the carapace actually formed from the ribs or whether it formed from these other bones that some reptiles kind of have underneath their skin. And it was wondering whether it kind of formed from like the combination of those. But this kind of, if this is a relative of turtles, this helps kind of suggest, at least it is possible that this sort of carapace could have formed from ribs. Another fossil that is interesting in this sort of early evolution of the turtle shell is a specimen that was found in 2008, and it's called Odontocelles semitestaceae, and it was found from about 220 million years ago, and it had teeth and a bottom shell, and its wide ribs hinted at the beginning of a top shell. So this is another one that kind of helped prove the idea that actually the carapace is likely to have formed from the ribs instead of another method. So it had a fully formed shell on the bottom, but it didn't have any shell on top. So it had no body covering on the top of its body, which is kind of cool. So it's sort of an in-between turtle. And then in 2015, scientists then found another specimen called Papocelles rosiniae, and it's a 240 million-year-old specimen, and it's missing its top shell, and it has kind of the first signs of this bottom shell. But what's cool about this one, and it kind of alludes back to when I was talking about the skull, is that unlike modern turtle skulls, it has two pairs of opening in its skulls. So this helps kind of suggest that actually turtles are probably closer related to diapsids, which are the skulls that have two fenestral openings, so two openings behind their eye sockets. And then they've actually just lost them instead of them being an apsids. So then further again in 2018, another specimen kind of helped fill some more of the gaps, which is Erorhynchocoelis. And it has kind of a single pair of holes between the eyes. So this kind of suggests the gradual transition. So again, this is kind of a further support for the idea that they've lost their fenestral openings. And because the genetic studies kind of over the last, say, 20 or so years have positioned crocodiles, dinosaurs, and modern birds as turtles' closest relatives. But then some studies and kind of turtle anatomy have pointed to lizards and snakes being their group's closest relatives. So it's kind of interesting. So they're kind of related to this group, but it's not sure who. They're still kind of up in the air about actually which part of this group they're related to. But it's really fascinating. So this is how the turtle appears to have gotten its shell, its ribs sort of spread out, and from there we've got turtles.
Cool. Well, that does bring us to an end of this week's episode. We will be back next week, where our theme will be transitions. Yeah, as a transition to the next episode, puts a lot of pressure on me to sort of make some sort of witty remark, but yeah, I've got nothing.
You can just fade out.
Just fade to black. Mm-hmm. Which is quite difficult on an audio medium.
Yes.
If everyone could just slowly close their eyes.
Turn the lights down low.
Yeah. And listen to our theme song.
But don't do that if you're driving.
Good point.
Well, that does bring us to an end for another week. So for this week, from everyone here at The Natural Selection, it's goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Okay.
Right. So the clip.
I was gonna say.
Just go die, like they did.
It did, yeah.
You said that with a sort of glee, which makes it seem like it might have been your doing.
Yeah.